I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Many women in the United States today spend their 20s unmarried, while most of their mothers and grandmothers were married by the time they were 29 years old. Single women make up almost one, or made up, I should say, almost one quarter of the electorate in 2012, helping to send President Obama back to the White House. Women are older now when they have their first child. In 2013, about half of first-time births were to unmarried mothers. Our guest, Rebecca Traister, delves into the history and trends behind these statistics in her new book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. She looks at class and race, sexual orientation, female friendship, urban life and literature, and talked to a broad cross-section of women who are increasingly saying, "I don't." Rebecca Traister is writer-at-large for New York Magazine, a contributing writer for Elle, wrote a book in 2010 called Big Girls Don't Cry about the 2008 presidential campaign, and she is back with us on Radio Times. Rebecca Traister, nice to have you with
us on Radio Times. It's so nice to be here. I love being on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much. Let's begin with you, because you are no longer one of these single ladies.
No, I am
you are a married lady with a couple of kids.
Yes, and I'm straight married, and I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which is like,
Every stereotype in the world.
I got married when I was 35 years old. And I do, I write about it in the book, the fact that I'm married. I don't try to hide this fact. I was single for, still, I'm 40 now. So I still have spent about three times the number of adult years as a single person than I have as a married person. And I think that when I was single, as I was, through almost all of my 20s. I had a sort of one on and off relationship in my 20s for a few years and into my early 30s. I didn't have, I wasn't a person who was in and out of monogamous relationships or even in and out of thrilling sexual relationships or unthrilling sexual relationships. And I think that, and many of my friends who were also unmarried during that period were in and out of relationships. And I wasn't. I didn't have a boyfriend in high school. I didn't have a boyfriend in college. I very rarely had a partner. And I think that perhaps, I think I identified through a good deal of my adulthood as very single, not simply single, but extra single, which I think probably led me to think about these issues even in advance of writing this book.
And I do want to get to all the issues, but you do write about, and I'm assuming people that are single for longer periods of time, not just that they get set in their ways, but there are certain ways that they just do things, and there are certain ways that they live their life that seems comfortable and predictable and reliable.
Right. Well, I should note that especially for women, we get, when we live singly, there are all kinds of messages. You're getting too closed off. I was told this all the time, especially when in my late 20s, I was able to rent an apartment on my own, and I began to live alone, and I developed all of my habits and everything. And I got very protective of my time and my space. And I had friends, especially since I was this person who was single and was rarely in a relationship, but who wanted to fall in love and was not, and talked about that. You're getting too closed off. You're getting too. But it's interesting, the habits we develop if we live independently that are not in service to partners or children. I mean, we have to remember that the default normal for women throughout most of our history for generations has been that you don't get set in your ways because you are worried about other people's ways. And so I do think there's an extent to which we continue to pathologize women just living the way they want to live on their own. And, you know, we get told that that's being too closed off or too controlled or too rigid. And it's like, oh, or maybe I'm just living my life fully as I have the ability to live it.
Well, you have an interesting chapter on female friendships and perhaps the kind of friendships that adult single women have or develop with each other over time. Do you think there's something unique about that?
Well, I think that I write about friendships at length because I think that the seriousness of the role of friendship is often overlooked and dismissed. And I think that for many of us, especially as there are more unmarried women in the world, you know, you mentioned this at the beginning of the episode, but only 20% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 are married right now. And that's compared to 60% in 1960. So, and many women are not necessarily in what we would think of as traditional romantic or sexual relationships. But rather than being single, which is the word that gets thrown a lot around a lot, including by me, they're actually in very intimate, functional, daily emotional relationships and have commitments and responsibilities to other people, often their friends. And I think that we are still, again, set to the idea that our intimate relationships are with spouses or our romantic partners, but in fact, women are living as each other's de facto spouses and as families all over the country, and in many configurations, often not just as pairs, but in triads, as groups. They vacation together. They're the people who fill out their health insurance forms together and make decisions about jobs and give job advice and gossip about who's at the office and watch award shows and baseball and argue about politics. And those are the relationships. And we still think of ourselves as growing up, I think, within traditional marriages, but we're often growing up alongside our friends.
Is this, though, that women are, quote unquote, rejecting marriage? Or is it about delaying marriage, redefining marriage, holding off on marriage? Because it seems even some of the women that you talked to, including Gloria Steinem, was married for a short period of time. Her husband
in
did
her 60s.
In her
60s.
No, 60s. Fair enough.
Yes.
Anita Hill has a long time boyfriend, I mean, for lack of a better word, a man that's been in her life for many years now.
Right.
Is it marriage that's sort of on the chopping block?
Well, no, not at all. Well, maybe a little bit. But it's not about this dichotomy between these two binary options in which there's a married life and in which marriage is the thing that women kick off their adulthood with and the institution on which they are economically, sexually, socially dependent versus being unmarried, which is being unmarried for your whole life or being unpartnered for your whole life. What it is about if you lift off that model that persisted for generations and throughout most of our history, where in fact women were economically dependent. If they wanted to have sex lives, if they wanted to have families, it mostly had to be done within the institution of marriage. And if you remove that set of imperatives, what you get is this variety of options. Mm-hmm. And they may include marriage. They may certainly include love and sex and children, either outside or within marital unions. They may include same-sex partnerships, but now can also include, in ways that were not as historically possible, work, economic independence, economic stability, families, children outside of marriage, raised in different family structures, not in a hetero early married unit. There are now this sort of infinite variety of paths that women can take, winding around friendship, work, money, sex, love. And it will look a million different ways, like there are a million different women. But that wasn't the case historically. Everybody was sort of nudged down this one highway that began with marriage.
And how much do you think contraception had to do with that, the sort of decoupling of sex, children, and then possibly marriage?
A huge contraception and the legalization of abortion, the legalized ability of women to control their own reproductive lives was key for this. So was the sexual revolution. So was the women's movement, the civil rights movement that expanded professional, economic, and voting options to more women. Basically, those politicized and scientific and conscious movements toward greater equal opportunity, something closer to equal opportunity for women, have created the conditions for this mass behavioral shift, which is not necessarily self-consciously politicized. You asked earlier, is this a rejection of marriage? No, in many cases, it's I haven't yet met somebody who I want. But the fact that you can have the fact that you are able to not have to marry someone if you haven't met the right person is pretty revolutionary, that these conditions have been created where your life can be full of other things and you are no longer necessarily dependent on finding a person, that you can wait for the right person and still have a full, robust, complicated adult life as a woman is a revolution.
Well, and it's interesting, again, you have a chapter that looks at, you know, war and women and then what happened in the 1950s. As we know, in World War II, many millions of men went off to war. Women often had to take the jobs that needed to be done that were left behind. Men come back from the war. We have the 1950s where women had, in a sense, sort of give up some of the autonomy that they had. And marriage and family and the suburbs became this tableau in this country.
Well, especially for white middle class women.
Exactly.
And interestingly, it was white middle class women who, at the end of the 19th century, because so many men had moved west as part of westward exploration, and so many men had been killed in the Civil War, middle class white women began to marry at lower rates and had gotten very involved in a lot of disruptive social movements, abolition, suffrage, the labor movement, things that had a pretty explosive effect on the country in the early 20th century. country. And so there was already considerable political pressure, pressure from the medical establishment, from the popular press, to sort of move some of those very disruptive white women to re-encourage marriage as an early norm. And you really saw that kick in after the Depression and the World Wars, and you saw middle-class white women, a real government move to create these suburbs, you know, government-funded housing. And white women were very much sent the message that this should be the content of their lives and their goals. And middle-class white women were moved into those suburbs. At the same time, what was happening, the same mechanisms that were building those suburbs and building highways, the infrastructure, the government was making this kind of suburban, domestic, patriarchal, early married life not only possible, but the thing that middle-class white women should do. But the highways, the suburbs were... Black families were not allowed to move into them. The highways that were built to connect the work centers to those white suburbs were cutting off black neighborhoods. And black families, black men returning from service, weren't as able to take advantage of the GI Bill because they weren't admitted to universities, because they didn't have the kind of economic stability that would even permit them to go to college for 4 years. And you saw economic conditions worsen for black families, and there weren't the resources to nourish that kind of patriarchal family structure. And so for black families, you saw marriage rates begin to drop. And out of this combined, this thing that was happening simultaneously, in 1963, you have Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, which was this sort of explosion of anger out of those stultifying white suburbs. And in 1965, you have the Moynihan Report, which was looking at black poverty and diagnosing the pathological center as being women-led families. So the unmarried black woman became cited as the problem, responsible in some way for black poverty, when, of course, black poverty is part of what made marriage a less tenable institution for black families.
Because there wasn't the kind of, what, investment in the future possible with the kinds of laws that we had at that time?
Yeah, economic instability makes marriage unstable. It makes marriage very difficult. Now, this is the reverse of what conservative politicians will tell you. Conservative politicians say every day, if you read the right newspapers or listen to the right people, that we have a cure for poverty in this country. It's marriage. I believe the exact opposite, that economic instability, economic challenge makes marriage a very difficult proposition. If what you are... Because marriage, it matters who you're married to. It matters who your mate is. It matters what the economic challenges you face are. And so in communities where there are high rates of unemployment, high rates of incarceration, thanks to our incredibly racist and broken policing and incarceration system, of course, those things lead to higher rates of drug and alcohol abuse, makes it much more difficult for people to form partnerships that would necessarily be emotionally or economically stabilizing. And in fact, there are studies, I write about this in the book, where actually one of the only programs that has had a good impact on marriage rates and lowering divorce rates are programs where welfare benefits have been extended or expanded and offered people more economic stability. It tends to make their marriages more stable, too. So, yes, poverty actually leads to lower marriage rates.
We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Rebecca Traister. She's got a brand new book. It's called All the Single Ladies, subtitled Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. And again, she's writer at large for New York Magazine, a contributing writer for Elle. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Rebecca Traister. And just a recap here, the number of single women in the United States has increased pretty dramatically in the last half century. For instance, back in 1960, about 60% of women were married by the time they were 29 years old. Today, only 20% of women are married by that age. And it's not just that women are marrying later in life. Many more are choosing not to marry at all. That's what Rebecca Traister writes about in her new book, All the Single Ladies, 1-888-477-9499. You write that in 2009, that was when the proportion of married women dropped below 50%. Of course, that was right at the beginnings, the heart of the economic recession in this country that hit so many people so hard. Is there a connection between those two?
Well, I think that there is. I should note that there is this figure that over 50% of women are now unmarried. That does include women who are divorced, separated, and widowed. So that's not simply the unmarried.
Yes.
But it is true, certainly, that the recession and that, as I said, economic challenge makes it much harder for people to begin marriages. There are all kinds of stories that I'm sure you've read about millennials who are delaying marriage, or they don't have the resources with which to find homes, have children, do the things, you know, that we associate with marriage. There are also...
I think many just don't want to get married.
And many
when
just don't want to get married.
Well,
old. Again, it's funny because there's reduced economic opportunity for many of them. But especially when you're talking about women, you're talking about historically unprecedented levels of economic and educational opportunity and doors that are open to them that were perhaps not even open to their mothers, let alone their grandmothers or great-grandmothers. And so one of the things that I was hearing from – I interviewed about 100 women around the country, and one of the things that I heard from so many of them were sort of combined impulses. I'm not going to get married until I'm economically stable was one of them, and that was from across classes. And also for more privileged women who are in colleges or beginning careers, I don't want to be tied down. I want to be able to explore my own passions, pursue my own goals and ambitions before I wind up, responsible to another human being or other human beings. So it's combined factors that I think are leading to this.
You begin the book by talking about the House on the Prairie.
Little House on the Prairie. Yeah,
yeah, and that there were these stories that you read as a little girl that ended with a marriage. And for you as a little girl, it felt like, well, that was the end of her story. What was interesting was all the things she did before she got married.
Right.
Not the happily ever after.
Right.
Part.
Well, we know that marriage is as the end of a story, whether it's in those childhood coming of age tales, The Buildings Roman, and I talk about Jo March in Little Women, Anne Shirley in Anne of Green Gables, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and even Jane Eyre, where the end of the story, you know, the conclusive moment is they get married. And we know that a little bit also from Disney movies.
Sure.
And of course, lived experience, whether you yourself are married or whether you have friends or parents or anybody who's been married, you know that the wedding is really not the end of any story. But that was for women. Marriage was both the end of a childhood in which there was a sense of possibility, in which things were still open and in front of them, and the beginning of an adulthood in which, for many years, marriage was an institution that severely limited women's freedoms. And to many extents, we're still changing that. We're in the midst of shifting the meaning of marriage from a lot of directions. But we have to remember that until very recently, it was an institution on which women were dependent and that they needed it for economic stability. And of course, it brought many of them satisfaction and love and families. And many women have loved being married for many years. But marriage was also an institution that really contained and constrained women's ability to act independently in the world.
We have different stories now, or perhaps in the process of writing different stories. You have a lot to say about Sex and the City, although that's not exact. Wasn't your life.
It was not my life. But everybody thought it was. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yes. They thought that was – you were living the life?
Simply living unmarried in New York City at the turn of the millennium, which is when Sex and the City was airing. And I also was working as a journalist. So everyone was like, you're just like Carrie Bradshaw. I was like, okay.
That cost $500.
Right. I was wearing a black Gap skirt. That I had purchased in college.
I'm thinking of girls, for instance. I mean, that there are other stories that seem more reflective of how women, girls, young women, maybe even older women are thinking
today. As the numbers of unmarried women grow, you see the reflections of them in popular culture begin to shift and become more diverse. I mean, this is, you have the women in the Shonda Rhimes shows, Shondaland, which is all about, you know, in all of her shows, there are all kinds of interesting professional women. There was Mindy Kaling's show, certainly Girls, Broad City, which is a very popular show. And these are much grittier versions of single life than Sex and the City. was a kind of pioneer show. And as such, it was in many ways a cartoon and a symbolic cartoon in which a lot of the material excess, the shoes and the closets and the clothes and the sex even, was blown up to cartoonish proportions to make a larger point about new kinds of freedoms that were being enjoyed, especially by the kind of very privileged, very wealthy, very white women who were the centers of that show. But it was, I mean, this is in the book, I have an argument with the television critic, the New Yorker television critic, Emily Nussbaum, who's a valiant and persuasive defender of Sex and the City's merits, about my own ambivalence about that show and its whiteness and its privilege and the way I felt it closed people off. And Emily very persuasively argues, as she has in print, this was a groundbreaking show about women who were terrifying in their independence, terrifying in their sexual appetites, terrifying in their power. It's a really important show. And so I sort of include both perspectives on that in the book.
I'm also curious about the fact, and this seems to have come out in the last, 10, maybe 15 years, when you look at the numbers of women who are now lawyers or doctors or in positions of management. It's very different from, you know, your parents, my parents'
Certainly.
Generation.
Yeah, women are moving into new realms, and it's slow. We're always simultaneously surprised by the lingering inequality in the number of, you know, law school deans who are women or CEOs who are women is still astonishingly small compared to the number of white male CEOs and law school deans and all. And yet, we're also in this process of seeing universities and graduate schools fill with women, in many cases more women than there are men. Again, we are very much in a sort of ongoing process of seeing doors open to women that had been shut for a very long time. And there are all kinds of confusing effects. I mean, we saw there was a big story in the New York Times a couple of days ago about how when women move into professions, formerly male professions, the pay drops when they're considered primarily female professions. You're seeing female-dominated professions shut out of some of the social policy fixes. For example, when California passed its paid sick day legislation a couple of years ago, home health care aides were left out of the initial legislation. Now, that's a female-dominated field and largely dominated by women of color. So you still see ways in which even as women become larger percentages of the workforce, they are still experiencing all kinds of gendered challenge.
Well, and you make very clear, and you're making very clear on the air about the racial and class divisions when talking about – we're talking about women here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about women in marriage and single women – is that there are almost like two different tracks.
Well, I would say it's less that there are two different tracks. It's just that the economic inequality that we talk about a lot when it comes to democratic politics and that we must be talking about also, of course, has an impact on women who are living independently. And in part, this is why part of what I'm arguing in the book is that we need to really revolutionize our social and economic policies, because things like raising the minimum wage, which is an issue on the Democratic side, half of minimum wage workers are unmarried women, many of them mothers. 42% of single mothers in this country live below the poverty line. And this is where conservatives come in and say, well, they should get married because marriage will fix that. Marriage will not fix that. But what is true is that we do not have government policies that support women who are earning and heads of families in the way that we have for generations supported men as heads of families through tax breaks and government loans and housing opportunities and even in white male enfranchisement, which began at the founding and has been protected ever since. We need to now revise our system so that they better support and acknowledge the way Americans are living, which is for long periods or entire lives outside of marriage, which was this organizing institution.
Do you see changes afoot?
Yes. I mean, slowly. I'm not saying they're coming around the bend next week.
Nothing does.
Yeah.
Or rarely does.
Rarely does. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk, for example, this election season about the dramatic lurch left of the Democratic Party. Here we are talking about things like minimum wage hikes, about paid leave, which was a third rail issue until very recently. You know, paid sick day legislation, subsidized early childhood education and child care, all these things which are absolutely necessary and key to what we need to revise in terms of our social and economic policies. And it's funny because people sort of associate the lurch left with Bernie Sanders, who is an older white man from Vermont. But part of my argument is that this perceived lurch leftward is actually a reflection of the changing realities of the Democratic base and the fact that these policies don't represent some self-conscious ideological shift to the left. They represent, wait a minute, this makes sense for how we're living now. Mm. this is, we need paid leave. We now have women who are earners within and without marriages, who are single mothers or who are married co-earners or breadwinners within their traditional hetero marriages or same-sex partnerships. It's really backward that we do not have any kind of paid parental leave in this country. And this now makes sense because we're not organized in a way we used to be.
But are you saying women are the base of the Democratic Party?
Yes, women of color.
Well, women of color certainly have lined up behind Hillary Clinton.
Yes, and although that's not the full story either, because white women and especially unmarried white women, especially in some of the early voting states, lined up hugely behind Bernie Sanders. It's interesting. There are all kinds of explanations for why one might prefer Bernie over Hillary or Hillary over Bernie. But for me, the interesting thing is that the policy differences between them at the moment are pretty paper thin. And what they are both doing is offering a version of Democratic policy ideas that are that is very far to the left of what we've seen from mainstream Democratic candidates until very recently. And I believe that that is a reflection of the fact that the Democratic Party is addressing the way that we need to better address how Americans are living now, which is not organized into husband and wife units.
And that's Rebecca Traister, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And she's got a new book. It's called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Throwing a lot of stuff at you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think. I haven't entirely thought this through, but as I was reading your book and seeing women either delaying marriage or deciding not to get married at all, and then thinking of the Supreme Court's decision on marriage equality, the idea of that if you're gay or lesbian in this country, you can legally get married. So there's this interesting kind of push and pull about this particular institution.
Yeah, well, there's a very persuasive argument, and I cite this in the book, that the legalization of gay marriage and more the movement toward it is actually a kind of traditional retro reinscription of this traditional fundamentally patriarchal institution on a group of Americans who have lived outside of it in a revolutionary way. And I think that that is a very plausible argument. And it's certainly supported by the language in the Obergefell decision from this summer in which I wrote about this at the time, the language about single people and marriage in that decision was super retro. It was about how marriage makes two people greater than what they once were, with the implication that what you are as an unmarried person is fundamentally less than what you are as part of a married couple. That is a very sort of retro take, and taking gay marriage as a traditional return. However, my argument is actually that the movement toward gay marriage goes hand in hand with the movement away from marriage as a social and economic imperative for women, because it changes the meaning of the institution, because it's no longer an institution whose purpose in part is to organize and dictate a gendered power structure in which men have certain kinds of power and women do certain kinds of work. And if you make it an institution that's no longer premised on a hetero partnership in which that power is going to fall according to a certain pattern, you're fundamentally remaking the institution to mean something different, and that it will act as a different kind of partnership for the people who enter it, gay or straight, into the future. So I think there you can look at it from
what people do or can do with institutions that have been around for a long time.
And we hope that they can do it. And part of what I argue in the book is that even though it's a difficult push and pull, and there's a lot of fighting about this, and there's a lot of personal pain and anxiety that people feel around marriage and singlehood in this country, our willingness and our ability to be flexible about what marriage means in this country, to legalize gay marriage, to move to slightly more egalitarian marriages, is actually saving marriage, or certainly hetero partnership. If you look at some of the other places in the world, including Japan, we're not just a country that's more inflexible about gender roles, where it's not just that marriage rates are falling through the basement, it's that there are all kinds of reports about men and women not even really wanting to couple because there has been such rigidity.
Not wanting to be intimate with each
other. Not wanting to have sexual relationships with each other. There's been so much rigidity about not wanting to be flexible about how power between men and women is organized, that it's sending all kinds of coupling rates into the toilet. And here, though the marriage rate has fallen, it's fallen all around the world.
Right.
Here, and actually in some of the Scandinavian countries where the marriage rates have been lower, but where they have the kind of social supports that support independence outside of marriage, the marriage rates have remained relatively stable in some of those Scandinavian countries, whereas in the places like Italy and Japan, where they used to be much higher, they have really fallen below Scandinavian rates. So,
and what we hear from Scandinavia is that while people might not be getting married, they are living together long term, raising children together. I mean, just not under the heading of marriage.
Well, there's all kinds of research that shows that children in unmarried but cohabiting committed relationships in Scandinavia are much less likely to see their parents break up than children in married relationships here in the United States.
Something to think about.
Something to think about.
I mean, it does raise questions about certainly about children. And on the one hand, it seems it's probably good that if people decide to get married, that they do it when they're older and not younger. I mean, you know yourself better. You probably can make better decisions for yourself.
Well, I think what I'm interested in is the diversity of options. So I think that there are plenty of instances in which you might meet a partner who enhances your life when you're very young. I certainly know people who've been together since they were in high school and have happy, seemingly egalitarian marriages that satisfy them both and have happy family units. But what we know from lived experience is that certainly not all of us, probably only a small minority of us, actually meet that person who makes a good match, something that makes our lives better when we're young. Some of us meet that person in our 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, or don't ever meet a person who really improves our life in a way that is powerful enough that we want to hook ourselves to them legally or commit. And so it's not so much, allowing everybody more time to meet a greater diversity of people, to pursue their own interests, to get closer to where they want to be in life themselves, seems to have a good impact on marriage. The states where the marriage ages are the highest are the states where the divorce rates are the lowest. So there does seem to be a correlation between late marriage as a general trend and more stable marriage. But I wouldn't prescribe it as an individual solution for anyone. I wouldn't prescribe anything as an individual solution for anyone.
We're talking options here.
Yes.
And we're talking with Rebecca Traister, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's a writer at large for New York Magazine. She's a contributing writer for Elle. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, in fact, a 2010 called Big Girls Don't Cry, and that was about the 2008 presidential campaign. She got a new book. It's called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I see some folks want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and do join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Rebecca Traister about the fact that the number of single women in this country is on the rise. Her book is about how these single independent women are making a big impact on America, transforming culture and politics, the economy, and that's what she writes about in her new book, All the Single Ladies. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Question from Joy. Historically, there have been times when large groups of single women have changed society. Does she think the current group of single women might have a similar effect? And you talked about abolition and voting rights and some of the activists, I guess, of the early 20th century, late 19th century. Do you see similar women today?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what we're experiencing today is less of a self-consciously organized, politicized movement. There's something that we addressed a few minutes ago, which is I do think that the changing conditions and realities for how adult women are living is forcing a reexamination of our social and economic policies with regard from everything to everything from paid leave to higher minimum wages, paid sick day legislation. I also think another way that contemporary extended singlehood for women and independence for women is altering the nation is in shifting the definition of families, which is a really radical move. Again, it's not the abolition movement. It's not the suffrage movement. This is not something around which people are organized. But we are rapidly changing our definition of what a family looks like in many directions. And so there are single parented homes. There are same sex couple parented homes. There are communal parenting situations. I also think you're going to see some pretty dramatic changes in housing because so many people live independently. and not in the kind of housing units that we sort of created so much of America's housing infrastructure around. And probably that will also entail changes to housing policy and tax policy. But increasingly, you're seeing independent adults living in urban places where they live with some kind of communal shared living space or kitchen, and in smaller kinds of apartments, which also has an environmental impact. So I think that there are all kinds of ways in which this population is having a big impact on the nation. It's just not, it's not the same kind of organized reform movements that we saw in the 19th century, because we do things differently.
I mean, you have some interesting things to say about the, the urbanization of women. I mean, the fact that women, so of men, have, many have congregated either to cities or living in cities and finding community, finding communality there.
One of the fascinating things that I learned when I was reporting this book is that, because I knew statistics tell you there are more single women in cities than anywhere else. The marriage ages in cities are always higher than anywhere else. And single women, as it turns out, this is what I learned in my reporting, have historically always flocked to cities because there are wages in cities. There are jobs in cities. And one of the fascinating things that I learned, I was reading a book about early modern Europe where I read that, you know, sort of in early modern rural France, if a lace-making factory opened up in a town, all the single women from the country would run to it because here was
jobs,
an opportunity,
right,
to have a job and to experience, you know, maybe 10 to 15 minutes more of independence before an inevitable marriage. I'm being glib about it, but it's true that cities have for a long time offered women jobs, which are crucial to that's one of the conditions you need to be able to live outside of marriage, is something close to economic stability, which has been so hard to come by for so long for women. But also cities have all these other benefits for women. Cities play the role in some ways of spouse, because men historically have had either literal spouses to do the cooking, the maintenance of the home, and women haven't had any equivalent role. And even when men haven't had wives, there's been a paid support staff that can do that for them, and they've had more access to the kind of money that can pay for that kind of domestic work. Women haven't historically had that. But when they go to cities, there is public transportation, there's affordable food. You can walk outside your apartment and buy an egg sandwich and a cup of coffee, and you're not the one who's left to cook all the breakfasts. There are smaller spaces that you're not required to clean, to take as much time cleaning. Cities offer community. They offer neighborhood watch aspects. There's a single mother who speaks to me in my book about the safety she felt in a city, even though she was worried about certain violent aspects of the neighborhood she was living in, that having neighbors on the street sitting in lawn chairs, having neighbors in her apartment building as a single woman allowed her, there was somebody to watch the kid for 5 minutes while she ran to the laundromat or to get groceries. And cities offer that in the density of population. They also offer more social contacts, a deeper and broader pool of potential sexual or romantic mates, and they offer distraction and diversity of options and fun things to do. And cities and unmarried women are a really natural pairing.
Let me see what Robin from Germantown has to say. Robin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
As an atheist, I'm wondering if she did any look into correlations between rise in atheism and greater agency for women, and if there's any.
Whether atheism has given women more agency, more autonomy. Have you looked at that, Rebecca Traister?
I didn't look specifically at the numbers, for example, of self-identified atheists and marriage patterns. But one of the things that is certainly true, I talk to women who come from a variety of religious backgrounds, and it is certainly true that in some religious communities, there is still a more intense pressure to marry and to marry early, and that's one of the differences that I explore. I would think that certainly, if not atheism, a more secular life has in some ways enabled more independent life for women. However, conversely, I should point out that prior to independent life and economic stability being an option for women who didn't find a mate or didn't want to marry, the church actually, the convent was historically one of the only off-ramps, one of the only socially viable off-ramps for women who were not marrying. I mean, and nuns have been a political force for centuries and a social force. So there are complicated relationships between religion and singlehood for women.
Robin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me just read some comments here. This is to you, Rebecca. Rebecca Tracer is amazing. It's like she's saying the words in my brain, but way better. Fantastic interview. Phenomenal woman. That's from Erica. An email from Tammy. I'm in a stable, loving relationship with a long-term partner. We have two children and home together, but no real desire to get married. However, as the children grow and enter school, we're discovering it may make it easier on us. Anything from taxes to having to explain over and over again the differences in our names. Marriage at this point has become more like a business decision. And I don't think Tammy's alone in this. And maybe that's not the worst thing in the world.
Well, I don't know. It's not maybe not the worst thing in the world, but I do wish we lived in a world where there weren't these kinds of even clerical benefits that accrued to married people that don't. And it's not just clerical. She's talking about tax benefits. That's
absolutely
very real. Housing benefits, very real. You know, I was in the ER briefly for a non-serious thing a few weeks ago, and one of my best friends, there was a decision. Is my husband going to be with me in the ER or is he going to be home watching the kids? And it was that my friend, who would have been much more natural for him to put the kids to bed and my friend to come with me to the ER, but she wasn't going to, she couldn't get past the ER people because she wasn't my next of kin. And my husband was.
So like gay couples in the olden days.
Yeah.
Right?
But this is a reality. I mean, there's a story in my book about two best friends and one of them, you know, is in the hospital or in a medical care center and she can't have her friend come be on the front desk. And so she's alone back there. But in fact, the people are live-in, long-time co-parents or our best friends who need to come with us to the emergency room. You know, these kinds of laws that, again, are designed around one kind of familial configuration, one mm-hmm. kind of social set of commitments, don't adequately address our needs today.
Thanks for that comment. An email from Beverly says, since the use of ladies was one of the historically kept women in their place with proper behavior, and women have demanded the use of women to show their independence, why use ladies in the title?
Well, I use ladies in the title specifically because it was in reference to the Beyoncé song. However, I do make, as a writer who writes about women constantly, I make very liberal use of all of the synonyms I can find for women. So I have been known to use
spinster.
Oh, I use broads. I use dames. I will use, I mean, when you write all the time, hundreds of thousands of words about women, you'll reach for pretty much anything you can get.
So ladies works for you.
Ladies is okay with me. I also respect a critique of it, though, I will say, but I will continue to use it.
An email from Ali. Do you think the reason why there is less marriage is because there are more women than men? And I mean, there might be a little bit more. I'm not sure it's a dramatic difference.
Well, there is. There's a lot of historical correlation with in terms of gender ratios and marriage patterns. So that in communities where there are many fewer women than men, you see very, very high marriage rates mm-hmm. and low marriage ages. So that's possible, but I don't think it's in any way. I mean, it's probably related tangentially, but I don't think it's the core reason for why we're going through what we're going through.
Email from Meredith. I'm the breadwinner in a same-sex marriage with two kids, and I'm loving this interview. We only marry to make sure our kids have both of our names on the birth certificates, but our kids do like knowing we are married now that we are older. I mean, there are a million different stories mm-hmm. about how and why people get married or stay together mm-hmm. or a couple.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's interesting. This is a same-sex couple for whom this right was denied until very recently. When you look, if you look at what happened after emancipation, because marriage wasn't legally recognized for enslaved people in the United States during slavery, and conversely, it was forced on some slaves by owners. And after emancipation, black marriage rates went higher than white marriage rates because there was marital liberty. So I think that there are, you know, the experience of gay couples who haven't been able to wed, who haven't had this option in front of them, is going to be one in part of liberation and excitement that this is a possibility now on offer to them. And I think that that's true on a personal level for many people, too. Many people who have been single their whole lives and then fall in love and then they want to get married because they never, you know, there are all kinds of personal versions of this story. I think that part of the movement forward is to make it an option for everyone and not a necessity.
You began, I don't want to get too personal here, Rebecca Tracy, but we began talking a little bit about you and about the fact that you married in your mid-30s. Mm-hmm. Was it, I mean, it was Mr. Right? It was just
the right time?
Yes,
I fell very deeply in love, which was a very...
to your own surprise?
Totally to my own surprise, because I didn't have a good romantic track record, and I'd actually never experienced love really is a positive thing. I mean, I'd been in love. I'd been in unrequited love. I don't want to minimize. I had, you know, the man I was in an off and on relationship with was a lovely man with whom I remained friends. But I didn't have any experience that either the movies or many of my friends told me that a romantic partnership could be about something that was thrilling and comforting and exciting and where I felt really known and like I knew someone and connected. And so there wasn't the expectation. I just sort of thought, I don't know that this particular thing is going to be for me. You know, I don't know that I'm built for it. I don't know that I'm going to meet anybody
so
who wants me.
So you weren't looking, so to speak.
Well, of course I wanted to feel that experience, but I was not a good dater. Let's put it that way. I was not. And I, again, going back to something we spoke to at the beginning, I think many people said you're closed off. I chased people away when they crowded me too much. And I think I probably bought into that. However, as I write in the book, some of that being closed off and chasing people away when they... turned out to be prophylactic, because when there was a guy who actually showed up who I wanted to spend my time with, I didn't want to chase him away at all.
There you go.
I just fell in love with him.
There you go. Let me get George from Wayne to join us on Radio Times. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. Just calling to find out whether she has statistics on any of the commensurate changes in men's perspective or male views. Sure. And over the same period of time.
George, it's a good question, and our guest is nodding her head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is the other half of the story. In a world in which heterosexual marriage remains the vast preponderance of marriages, marriage rates have fallen for men and women. Marriage ages have risen for men to above 30 as the median. And there is – I do write about men in the book here and there. It's really a book about women. And there should be many books about men's changed perspective on marriage, because this is a world that is altered for them too. But the reason that I focused on women's changed perspectives is because it is the real disruption of what has been. Historically, while marriage has been a norm for men too, there has been the ability, there's been space in the world for independent men. There's been the ability for them to live economic, professional, even to have sex lives outside of marriage that didn't end in social censure or poverty. And for women, these things are all really new. And so the book is about women for that reason, is that that's where I see it being a revolutionary shift. But the shift is very present for men too.
A tweet from Erica. Any thoughts about ways to relook at the welfare system to better support women?
Yeah. Well, my ideas for how to relook at the welfare system to better support women is that we actually have to support those women. One of the things that happened with welfare reform in the 1990s is that the government began to treat women as if they were all workers, but then didn't offer the kind of supports, for example, paid leave or subsidized daycare or paid sick days, that would enable them to be in the workforce in any stable way. I'm also somebody simply, I cited earlier in the interview, these studies that say increasing welfare benefits rather than reducing them, which is what the government wants to do all the time, increasing welfare benefits actually makes all kinds of options more available to women, including more stable relationships. And so I am very much in the camp of increasing welfare benefits and increasing the other kinds of protections that make make life more stable for more Americans.
Almost out of time here. You wrote a book in 2010, Big Girls Don't Cry, about the 2008 presidential campaign. Any chance to rewrite or update that as we carry forth? And we've got the same woman running for president.
We do.
Hillary
and we've
Clinton.
Seen a lot of the same patterns, a lot of the same generational divides, although interestingly racial divides that have redounded to her this time. I think we're seeing a lot of the history of 2008, not repeated, but updated and shifting in front of our eyes. It's fascinating to watch as someone who diagnosed the last, who did a pathology report on the last campaign, watching this one come to life.
Has Do you have been a diagnosis for this one?
Nope. No idea what's going to happen. No. I think we probably, I think this is one where we may not know what's going to happen until November 6th.
Until the actual
Until
election
it's
day.
Actually happening. I don't know that any of us is going to know for sure how it's going to end.
Well, on that note, we do have to end our conversation. Rebecca Tracer, thank you so much for joining us today
on
Radio
Times. Thank you so much for having
me. Oh, you're so welcome. And again, the book is called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. And again, Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine, a contributing writer for Elle, and yes, wrote a book in 2010 called Big Girls Don't Cry. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can check out what our guest looks like. We've posted some photos on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.